Dewey's here at Groundswell this year, the 26th and 27th of June, close to London, UK. Many friends of the podcast will be there. John Kempf, Abby Rose, Benedict Boezel, Henry Dimbleby, Claire Hill, Russ Carrington, Andy Cato, Tim Coates, and many, many more. See you there. Wide-ranging is an understatement of today's conversation. We discuss everything from why we should focus on solutions that work for all farmers, not just the regen organic ones. The production of biostimulants, on-farm or off-farm, microalgae, nutrient density and quality, and why it all starts in the soil. And we finish up with a masterclass on smelling soil. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investing in regen ag. That is gumroad.com/investing in regen ag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. And today, welcome back, Jasmine. We had you in May last year, in 23, in the spring. And I really wanted to have you back here. This is part of a series where we unpack the video course we released at the end of last year in 23. And of course, with you, we're going to discuss a lot of things, but we're going to also discuss nutrient density and nutrient quality and unpacking that piece. So I'm so happy to have you back. We covered a lot of the research you were doing last time, and very happy to have you back now to join us more for a conversation around nutrient density, quality, and what of this, which is really one of the key pillars of our video course and of course of many episodes we've made in the past. But we're going to dig a bit deeper into that. So welcome back. And thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be back. I really enjoyed our last conversation. So also nice to get to expand on that a bit more. I feel like we had just touched the surface of a lot of different topics.
Yeah, last time we managed to record in person, and this time we will do it virtually, but with video. I mean, we're not recording a video, but it helps with the conversation. So it's almost as good as in person. And
yes,
just to, because these kind of conversations are also really nice as a sort of feeler to see what's happening in the space. You've been in the regeneration space for a while. And so I'm always curious what excites you, what interests you, which rabbit hole you've been falling into. and so lately, let's say on the nutrient quality, the nutrient density piece, what is something that really, really touched you or interested you or got your attention? Because I think we should pay attention to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say what I'm really excited about these days is the power of biology in the soil, and specifically biodiversity of biology in the soil. So the variety of microorganisms, the incredible number of bacteria and kinds of bacteria that we're just still learning about, and how those interact with the fungi, and then get eaten by the arthropods. So understanding what sort of ignites the biology to get going, to really be working, is an area that I'm really excited about, because there's so much that we are just beginning to learn. I mean, even from, I know there's like this carbon tunnel vision, and I'm not so enamored, let's say, with talking about carbon so much, but I thought it was absolutely fascinating. This research piece came out last year. I think it was May of 2023. That basically changed the way that we understand how carbon is locked in the soil. So they were looking at fungi. Merlin Sheldrake, who I'm a huge fan of, if you haven't read Entangled Life,
I'm reading it now, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. It's like a part of it is just footnotes of all of the studies he really goes into and describes that he mentions. But this paper that they put out, basically, they didn't do new research. They leveraged the power of AI to look over a much larger data set of studies. And they discovered that fungi, or the necromass of fungi, so dead soil fungi, are responsible for up to a third of sequestered carbon when we're looking at carbon stocks. So the role of fungi in keeping carbon in there, we didn't even know that. And here we have these huge carbon markets that are developing, getting super complex, and they still don't fully understand how to keep carbon in the soil. So that to me is just, an example of how much we have yet to learn. And I think how much is unfolding almost on a monthly basis, both in the soil from a diversity aspect, but I would also say from a nutrition aspect, because those two are so linked. So the other area I would say is, nutrient densities taken on, its own, pedestal, let's say. it's getting a lot of attention, but what does it mean? And so really defining what that means, I think, is important. You mentioned quality, nutritional quality. I like to also say nutritional richness, because what we're really talking about is understanding the variety of nutrients that are important. And some of those are just teeny tiny amounts, but the human body needs a teeny tiny amount in order to function properly. And we're just beginning to understand that, both from a human gut.
To the biodiversity or the diversity in bacteria you just mentioned.
Yes, exactly. So that is mirrored by the gut microbiome and the diversity of microbes in our own stomachs that we are just beginning to understand. And the signaling also from those microbes to our brain, to hormones, to how that affects our mood and emotions. Again, we're just beginning to understand, but there's definitely a link between those communities, let's say, of bacteria, and then the soil bacteria communities. So,
and how does it feel to be like, and I will link the paper below you mentioned, actually, Toby Kears, who is a co-author, was on the show.
Yes, Toby Kears.
I'm reading Entangled Life, and like that whole new, like in a space where suddenly a paper, and this is a meta one, but just changes our thinking completely because we knew but didn't really know that carbon was stored by mycelium networks. Like it's suddenly out of nowhere, our world is being put upside down. How does it feel for someone working in this space and to be in that it could constantly shift, like in the biology space, in the soil, the biology space, in our gut, like every day a paper could come out and or research is being published that could shift that completely, or suddenly we discover a whole new set of bacteria. Like how does it feel to be in that explosion phase or sort of a sector
and
of
constant
space?
Change. That's a really good question. I would say because I'm more of a self-taught and less of a traditional academic type of scientist, it doesn't scare me at all. It doesn't concern me at all. I think uprooting 60 years worth of science, scientific papers, let's say, with new findings is beyond exciting, because instead of being like, oh my gosh, it means everything we thought we knew, we didn't know. It's like, yeah, but how much potential is there to be uncovered? We have these looming challenges with climate change. We have these major issues with, availability of fertilizers on a large scale.
The cost.
Yeah, the huge cost. And, people are going, how are we going to feed the world? Well, actually, we may discover with some of these new exciting things that are coming out that the way that we've been farming for the last 75 years is sort of like a Neanderthal version. And there's a whole new world to be discovered of working with the biology, working with natural systems. So I find it incredibly exciting. You need to be... Yeah, I would say coming from a mindset of embracing this uncertainty and looking at it as, the next great discoveries, I would say, for mankind. And I think that we're just beginning to see some of those. So that I get really excited.
And what have you changed, like, your mind about or your opinion or your beliefs recently in a space that's so fastly changing, what's something that I don't know, you thought to be true a few months ago and actually, or maybe a year ago when we talked, like what's something that was quite a switch recently, if there's one that really comes to mind? Maybe there are multiple.
That's a good question. Let's see. I would say, even having learned soil science from a slightly different direction, I was still convinced that the physical properties of soil and the chemical properties of soil were some of the most important in determining what you could do with that soil. So if you have a sand-based soil, you're going to have a low cation exchange capacity, your ability to hold on to nutrients and stuff, you're going to lose a lot of stuff to runoff. I thought that sort of texture component, comparing to, like, let's say a loam where you have a nice combination of sand, silt, and clay, the other three types of characteristics that are used to describe soil. I thought that was still incredibly important in terms of understanding what your baseline is and where your starting point is in a soil, and then how to regenerate that soil and build it. And I would say what has blown me away is that I think biology is more powerful than potentially both of those combined.
Wow.
Okay. And maybe that's a radical further statement. So,
like, could it be, I mean, what in plain English are you saying? I mean, I'm saying it doesn't matter what soil you are on, but there's a lot more possible, or what do you mean by?
I would say that you're not as constrained by what's possible based on your starting conditions. So, you know, because from a just physical standpoint, if you're going, okay, well, we have waste way too much sand, we're not able to hold on to our nutrients, the idea of lugging in pounds and pounds or large quantities of, let's say, more of a clay-based, or even having to bring in compost to physically change the structure of your soil.
Biology can do that.
Yeah. It's hard, and you're limited, you know, and I learned the hard way in diving into starting a biochar company that logistics is not easy. Transporting this stuff is not easy. It's expensive. It's heavy. And so the idea that actually there are vast unknown worlds of biology already in that soil, a lot of them are dormant, but that have been sort of not necessarily pre-selected, maybe by nature, but have co-evolved with those physical and chemical characteristics to make up for those. So,
how do you kickstart them, or how do you undorm, wake them up? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's what we're figuring out. So this is this whole new world of biostimulants and biofertilizers. A lot of exciting work, I would say, is just understanding what's there. So you've got different companies that are doing quite well, like Biomakers. I would say, I think Nature Metrics I think Rise Bio is another one I just recently stumbled on. But looking at the genomics, so the genetic sequencing of these different bacteria, there's something like 99.9% of soil bacteria cannot be cultured in a laboratory.
Which means
we can't study it. Yeah. We don't understand how they interact with each other.
Why is that? Because I repeated that. I think Elaine Ingham mentioned that as well.
Yes, Elaine Ingham.
The discovery of so many of these bacteria has been relatively recent because we only grew a few in a lab. Only a few survived when we brought soil to the lab.
Yes.
So our view was limited to only a few. I've been repeating that, but why is that? Why do so few survive outside the soil?
Yeah, great question. I would say it's because they are so sensitive to changes in their environment. So you're taking them from a very specific, let's say, temperature, moisture, and light situation. And just by moving them, you are vastly, you're opening up their world to oxygen, right? So you're going to be kickstarting you're going to change the conditions that some of those bacteria, they will cannibalize on the others. They're going to take advantage of that. Which is why when you till, killing or creating a situation where a different type of bacteria can eat maybe your beneficial ones. and it's immediately changed. So that's where we've been seeing a lot of push, I would say, to create in situ sensors. And that means putting sensors into the soil that can measure in place. The problem is that, please, if you know of some, I know people are trying to work on them, but I haven't found any in situ sensors with a real ability to look at the biology. Basics, yeah, but we're just not there yet. I mean, if we can't look at the biology in the most expensive, you pick any laboratory in the world, and still you're not going to be able to look at 99.9%. If we haven't been able to mimic the conditions of the soil in a lab to be able to study it, our ability and our rate of innovation and, let's say, ability to spend on that type of innovation isn't there yet to understand what's going on in the soil. I would say that's
huge
the next
opportunity.
Step.
Yeah. So inside or recreated in the lab, which of course is super difficult if you don't understand 99.9% of the bacteria. How do you recreate that? It also creates enormous opportunity in scratching the surface and a feeling like we're really at the beginning of any stimuli, because how do you know if you stimulating something if you don't know it's there to begin with? Like, how do you know
exactly.
if it's increasing or
exactly.
not? I mean, you can see the results. You can see more vivid plants, but that's multiple steps away from the actual act of doing something. So that's the tricky part, but very exciting. And
do you see
more people getting, do you see that space, the biostimulant space, or in general, this biology space? Because I think whenever a sector takes off or a theme takes off, it's because there are a lot of people really going deep in it, falling in the rabbit hole, starting to build things, maybe technology, maybe models, maybe labs, maybe stimulants, etc. But do you see an influx of talent into this specific theme within, let's say, regeneration?
Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say on a number of different levels. So you have a lot of very interesting biostimulant and biofertilizer companies coming out, a lot of startups coming up. What we're seeing is different approaches, because there are standard ones that have a set of microbes that we know to be beneficial. And so they'll sell them across an entire market space, but not necessarily specific to context. So the type of soil, the type of environmental conditions, temperature, water, and all of that, sunlight. And then you have others who, instead of having one set product, they're coming in, they're doing an assessment of the farm, of that context. They're trying to take the native species and then sort of incubate those, grow more of the beneficial ones, and then put them back in. And that's very labor intensive. That takes a lot of time. You need a large, very large facility. I mean, there's a biofertilizer lab on the Soil Heroes farm. Jeroen has been working on that with Mike, the farm manager, for a few years now. They've done amazing work. And I think that that's a huge part of their success in their regenerative approach. But not everyone can do that. I mean, that's a 360 hectare farm. And so they had space they brought Mike in specifically also in the wintertime. He's brewing. He's making these biofertilizers.
It's a brewery.
Yeah. And that's not something every farmer can do. So,
and do you see a future where everybody, like, what's, because one of the issues, I think, with biostimulants or with the whole notion, partly biochar and other things as well, is that sort of it stayed in the realm of do it yourself. Every farmer mm-hmm. should do it, could do it, look online and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. That rhymes. But and it just the reality is it doesn't happen necessarily, because not every farmer has the capacity, the resources, the space, that this is to do that, and the time. But at the same time, we know that doing it on your farm in your context in many cases is much better, because it is more, it travels difficult. Like, it's difficult to travel for not only because of weight, but also because of applicability and context. Like, how do you see that dance between on farm and near farm or far away farm in terms of inputs and biostimulants?
Yeah. So I think that that's going to change drastically. And this is another area where I've also had my own sort of aha of, well, wait a second, maybe there's another way of looking at this instead of our typical sort of let's apply the same way of doing something, but in a different, slightly different way and hope for a different result. So instead of coming in and saying, we're going to replace those missing microbes, which by the way, we don't fully know how many there were to begin with, how they interact with each other, or if these are really the ones that are missing or just the ones we think are missing. It's like, okay, let's take a step back. What do those microbes need in order to flourish naturally? Well, they need food. Right? They need root exudates. They need these sugars and different molecules and stuff. So what about just feeding the ones that are already there? So that's another idea of, okay, we can, instead of having to lug huge quantities of stuff, we can look at what stimulates these guys to grow. And then you're creating a natural environment where if you feed the good ones, or if you create a situation where the beneficials...
You don't know which good ones are good. That's there. Who are the good ones?
Yeah, exactly. But if we can figure that out, or if we can create a situation where it's more beneficial for the ones that are helping the plant to have a leg up. So looking at how to solve, looking at the problem differently and then figuring out how to solve it differently. So for me, I just discovered, I'm probably way late to the game, but microalgae as... I don't know that it would be necessarily a biostimulant so much as a soil amendment, but you only need teeny tiny quantities of it to get incredible results. And that's because it's like a 5 micron size. So it's super small. So it can also act as a carrier. So it'll carry different bacteria or even different nutrients into the root zone, inside the plant. And so that to me was like, whoa, wait a second. And then I discovered that they also work at night. So at night, they're converting carbon. So during the day to feed the photosynthetic process. And so I'm like, whoa, wait a second. So I was always thinking plants just have the daytime sunlight to grow. But if we can figure out who's active at night in the soil from a bacteria and fungi standpoint, and then encourage those, we're doubling the amount of time that we have to help get nutrients unlocked from those organic non-plant available forms in the soil, unlocked into plant available forms. And that to me, I'm just is like, the potential there, I think, is incredible. I really think that's sort of going to be the next step, is figuring out how to unlock these things. Also, there's an incredible webinar. Hold on. It's done by Green Cover. They do cover crops. It's Christine something, but she talks about the biodiversity in the soil, and she discusses chemical signaling and the sociobiome, how there's actually like a social concept.
Christine Jones. Yeah, I will put a link below.
Yeah. What was her last name again? Christine?
Jones, I think.
Jones. Yes, exactly. And that understanding how they communicate. So first, recognizing that the bacteria communicate with each other. That in and of itself is a novel concept, I would say, for myself. but that just kind of blew my mind and opened things up to a different level of, okay, instead of taking this paradigm of the ancient, let's lug all of these fertilizers in, to, okay, let's lug all of these biofertilizers or biostimulants in. Wait a second, take a step back. What's already in the soil? And what are, you know, almost from a systems change, what are the little levers? Where are the nodes? Where can we just put a little bit of leverage to have a more maximum result? And that means looking at biology in a different way and understanding biology and things like chemical signaling, quorum sensing, how do they talk to each other on a basic level? And how do they have friends, you know, from indigenous wisdom or ancient farming concepts and practices, they would use different types of words than modern agriculture does, of certain plants are friends with other plants, or they're enemies. They don't like each other. But I think that there's more to that than just the on its face. I think there's a lot to understand that there are symbiotic relationships amongst these thousands and thousands of different strains of bacteria and fungi. And Yeah, it's going to be exciting to find out who's friends with who under different circumstances are enemies. Maybe certain crops create more competition amongst what we would think were teammates. And so I think the way that we think about it is going to change. And yeah, I'm just really excited for every new sort of research paper that's coming out or studies. Yeah.
And then how do you see it going from exciting papers to like scale on the ground? Like if it's constantly changing, it's also very difficult to pick a thing and say, okay, we're going to build an advisory company around this or an input company or biosimilar. Like, yeah. Because if we keep researching until indefinitely, then we never hit the hectares, let's say, we need to hit. So how do you see that already with the companies you follow and the interest? Like, how do you see this going into practice? What are the routes to build a company at some point around it? And of course, for the investors listening to this, yeah, to put money to work at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it'd be identifying those companies that get it, that see how something could scale. Again, I think the microalgae is one example because you need such small amounts of it.
What would be a question to ask, like, to a company, like a company that gets it is quite a let's fake. Like, how do you? Okay,
I would want to understand what the problem is that they're solving. If it's just to replace conventional fertilizers, is that really solving the problem? I don't think so. I think that our industrial agricultural revolution, though it was revolutionary 75 to 100 years ago, now is a very old school way of doing things. So if we're just trying to replace a broken system,
replace broken ingredients or inputs with another broken ingredient.
That's not the type of solution that is going to scale or that's going to really reframe the way that we farm, which is what I'd say the potential of biology gives us. And so I would want to understand, how they see the problem. What they're solving for. So to me, the big concern right now is all of this carbon farming. Do we want to grow fruits and vegetables in order to get carbon out of the air? You know, in 10 years, we're going to find ourselves in the same position that we're finding ourselves now, where the nutritional quality of what we're eating has again been depleted or gone down because we were optimizing for the wrong thing.
And what I do you think mean by that? Like if we optimize for carbon, do we,
if we optimize for carbon,
or we by definition lower the quality?
I would say potentially lower, we would result in lower quality food because we're not focusing on how to improve that quality of the nutrients in our food. And that's the problem that we're finding ourselves in now from the industrial agriculture age, where we optimized, we genetically modified, we created synthetic fertilizers, synthetic pesticides, fungicides to have a high yield, to have uniformity, and to have pretty looking produce. And what that's left us with now is incredible nutrient declines across the board, as well as perhaps equally as important is a lack of flavor and taste. Nutrients, I am convinced, are equal to flavor. And I think that that's how humans co-evolved with the plant environment to know what to eat. Things tasted good because they were nourishing for our bodies. And so if you're not optimizing new biological growing methods in order to have a better nutrient content and a better flavor, then I don't think that that's the future of farming in terms of where we want to be in 10 to 15 years. I'd say landmark research study that came out, I'm sure you saw it, was on rice and wheat and the nutrient decline in rice and wheat in India. So this came out in December and I think finally made it into some articles, January, February, March of this year. And it was something like rice had declined in zinc and iron by 30% and 20%, and wheat by 19%, and I can't remember what the other one was. But the other thing that happened in that was there was an increase of 1,400% of arsenic in these food crops. And these food crops had 10 years prior been heralded as being saviors for feeding the world because of their ability to bring in bigger yields. And so we're poisoning ourselves because we're not optimizing for healthy food and for nutritious food from, I would say, the base standing point of what we're putting into our soil and how we understand how our soil works. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, those are the two main commodity crops that that information has come out on. There was one article that I read where the guy kind of synthesized from the research paper of at this rate, India's ability to feed itself with these two crops is going to be not appropriate by 2040. Like these two crops will not provide enough nutrition for the people that are eating it by 2040. That's around the corner. That's not that far away. And so what other crops is that happening to? What other foods is that happening to?
Yeah, what does that do to the, I mean, I'll put the links below of the article. Mm-hmm. I always say below, I mean, in the show notes on the website. But what does that do? Does it give a blow to this myth of, how are you going to feed the world with regenerative agriculture, whatever regenerative agriculture is in that sense? First of all, the counter to it is like you're not feeding nor nurturing a population at the moment. And at the same time, we need to have a discussion on the yield. Like, do you feel that these kind of articles slowly at least start to, that the Pandora box of how much we've declined in nutrient quality and adding other things to it, do you see there more attention for
absolutely
the quality piece, like how bad the quality got in depending on the crop, but in general, like across the board?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say across the board, we're seeing a change in I would say rhetoric, because it almost feels like politics at this point. I'm not sure that it's necessarily followed up by changes in practices. But from Unilever, Nestle, PepsiCo, I mean, all these major food companies, Mars, Kraft Heinz, they're all now starting to use this concept of nutrient density. They've all also, in addition to, I think how companies hire is important, but also the departments that they create. So I was watching who was hiring for regenerative agriculture people in the last, let's say, 3 to 5 years. And in the last year, there's been also a shift in I wouldn't say hires for nutrition, because what I've seen and what I've heard is that they're relabeling departments and now calling them like focus on food, bev, and nutrition. but I think at least that this is a conversation that is coming up and that companies are sort of restructuring how they operate internally is really important and is really I would say significant in terms that they're taking this seriously, that I think change will be coming.
And how, let's not underestimate, I think, how difficult that shift is going to be for food companies that, I'm not saying against their will, but in many cases, because of us and because of all the systems we created food offerings that most of the time are completely lacking nutrient quality or nutrients in general. I mean, we see the hype with ultra processed people, ultra processed foods, and because of the book and a lot of research coming out in the last decades on just not even on the quality of the ingredients, but just the ingredients itself that we've created to fill up food that, or as the Brazilian researchers like to call it, food-like substances. So the attention for that is starting to grow. And most of the food these big guys are selling is just food-like substance, not really food. So how do you see a path there for these big companies to take that seriously? Like you have a Ferrero that most of what they sell is just you shouldn't be eating that. And a Nestle is probably the same. And a Unilever, a big chunk as well. Some stuff, not so much. But there's a lot of it that's probably better if we don't eat it at all. And I understand they start taking this seriously, but this means like a night and day shift for most of their categories, let's say. And are they like, what do you feel and see there? This is complete speculation, but just that seems like a fossil fuel to renewable energy, like shift distributed renewable energy system for an energy company. Like that's as much as a shift as this almost.
Absolutely. So, in some ways, I would say I'm an eternal optimist, maybe a bit naive, but I think that at the end of the day, every person has a body and every body needs to be nourished. And so this is something that I think is different in the sense that everyone knows someone that's died of cancer recently. Everyone knows someone that is fighting some kind of autoimmune disease that maybe wasn't as prevalent before. And so this hits home. And I would say instead of
just... Is it different than 5 to 10 years ago? Like, is there a moment
yes,
now?
There is, because I think the science is finally coming out and without a doubt showing us that there are negative consequences to these kinds of chemicals that have been put into our foods. And you can't really deny it anymore. I mean, the EPA in the US just announced huge changes, essentially acknowledging that these forever chemicals have been in our drinking water and that they are responsible for things like cancer and a number of other things. But to go back to your question in terms of the food companies, the little hope that I got was I read this article the other day. I just found it again. It came out March 14th. And the title is Nestle Shareholders Call on Food Giant to Reduce Reliance on Unhealthy Products. So these are the shareholders. This is where we need to see the change coming from. They're the ones whose profits are going to be hurt. And they are recognizing, okay, this is not the way that we want these profits to be coming in. So I think that at the end of the day, I mean, the way that we improve soil health is through people implementing things. The way that we get these big food and ag companies to change their policies, potentially giving up some of their profits, is going to be through people, through connecting people to their own health and to making decisions that are in the best interest, not just for profits, but for the health of their families, the health of the environment. And I think that as we have more examples coming out, also from the healthcare perspective, there's Susanna, who we know here, but then you guys also have a quote from Aaron Martin in the US with Oklahoma RX, where they're giving people prescriptions for food to treat ailments that they had previously been. So they're giving them, just to clarify, food prescriptions. So putting them on very specific food diets.
That's not.
Yeah, it's the opposite. It's saying you need to eat these vegetables or these types of whatever greens or this kind of a diet in order to address this diabetes that you're dealing with or this or that. And the idea is to get them off of pharmaceuticals. And they're having incredible success and they're documenting that success. And these are not just anecdotes here and there. These are teams of doctors and nurses. And so I'd say seeing these stories firsthand, seeing the documentation of how food equals health and can improve health is the way forward. And something, a little random trivia that I just discovered.
I think that's going to be the title of this conversation. Some random trivia, super irrelevant, important to everybody listening, but it seems random, but it's not actually. Some random trivia I found in the closet. Now, that's why we interview and we have this conversation, because whatever you're discovering is relevant for our audience. So please go ahead.
So Lance Gunderson works with Rick Haney, and Regen Ag Labs is the only laboratory at the moment that you can get what is called a Haney test done for your soil. And the Haney test is like the regenerative farmer's new best friend, I would say, but also the conventional farmer's new best friend, because what it's trying to do is mimic as much as possible soil conditions, what we were talking about earlier, to understand nutrient cycling and nutrient management in terms of understanding what needs to be added. So the previous way of looking at our soil was with really harsh chemicals. It was how do we in a laboratory break down to find out what all of these different elements are that are in the soil, like the nitrates, the, you know, NPK, usually the main three soil nutrients that plants need. And they said, well, wait a second. A plant doesn't have those crazy harsh chemicals to make these types of nutrients accessible. What is available to the biology in the soil? And so they've created, I think it's like H3A, and it's supposed to emulate root exudates to be able to see what is in a water-soluble form available at the root zone for the biology to really activate and convert those, soil-based but not yet plant-available nutrients into plant-available nutrients. And so the Haney test, I think, is really incredible in terms of unlocking that potential. And we talked about yields earlier. I went down the rabbit hole last night on this concept of breaking the corn yield. And this is a concept.
I'm laughing. Nobody sees this because it's video, but we discussed this previously and I didn't want to throw up the ball. Let's see if it came up, but of course you came up. So go ahead. Another fun trivia that Jasmine found yesterday to continue our series.
I mean, I had heard about it. I read a headline of about a year ago, but I didn't look at it so much. And so this concept of breaking the corn yield. So there's a record for what the yield is for, I think it's a hectare of corn, or I guess an acre,
because
it's based in the U.S. And every year they weigh and they measure and they have a test plot and, you know, farmers compete to see if they can break the record. Well, believe it or not, and sorry for all of these big chemical fertilizer companies, but the winner now more than once has been a regenerative farmer. And not only that, a first generation farmer. So an innovator, someone who taught himself. And he, there were two. There was Hedrick, I think it was Tucker Hedrick, in 2022. And I think the other one was Chris Hula from Virginia. And I can't remember if it was both of them or one of them was a regenerative farmer, started off doing no-till and did reach the corn, broke this yield barrier, and set a new record. And the key was using biologicals. They also, they did bring in different fertilizers, but they used the Haney test. And they used the Haney test to be able to better understand exactly what was available to the root zone, to those microbes, to help aid their plants. And yeah, they chose the best genetics that they thought would work for their area. And they talk about how getting lucky with the weather that year is important.
Of course.
But I think that this Haney test, this ability to look at these, the biodiversity, if you will, in the soil, is going to be really critical to unlocking more solutions for biology at the root zone that then translates into food that has more variety of nutrients, not just a focus on, with, you know, tunnel vision of just NPK.
But so. It shows this, I mean, we semi mentioned it before, but now even more, like this yield focus and this constant argument you see on LinkedIn and other places, and we get all the time as well whenever I speak, okay, but how we're going to feed the world? And apart from the fact that we're not necessarily now, if we look at zinc and magnesium in iron, or in iron actually in rice and grain in India, let's leave that aside. Actually, if you do it well and you get extremely lucky and all of, but it's not, doesn't mean by definition sustainable or regenerative is less yield and less is now the most exciting farmers we know are actually more productive.
Yes.
And without all the inputs, or with way less inputs in the process.
Way like less inputs.
That's the cutting edge. It's the two of them together. Not like, oh, we have to do less and this and that. No, actually we're scratching the surface.
Yep.
And that's where we should focus our attention, the people that are combining the two, extreme productivity and a focus on soil regeneration, Haney test and all of that. But that notion is still, I find it very difficult to get in the head of many people, like, okay, it's the wizard or the prophet, or it's this or that. Now, actually, the interesting things are happening when people are pushing for crazy yields and do a lot of deep soil stuff. But that's... yeah, difficult message. I'll put the link below of the corn record of Hedrick and just to, but we have to, I feel like we have to keep repeating that.
Do you
repeat that a lot?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd read about it like a year ago and then I forgot about it. And that's why when I rediscovered it, I was like, wait a second, how come no one is repeating this anywhere? How come we keep hearing the same message from the big fertilizer companies of, well, you can't feed the world. How are you going to feed the world with, you know, but we don't see enough sort of spotlight put on those regenerative farmers, or those, maybe they're not 100% regenerative, but they're beginning to work more with natural systems and are getting better results, moving away from these synthetic chemical inputs. And the fewer and fewer synthetic fertilizers that you can use, at least for the food that I'm eating, I would say the better, you know. I think there's also polarization in the dialogue, and that's a big problem too. We have this sort of like regenerative organic is the gold standard. And if you're not doing all of these things, then you're just another conventional farmer. And I think that that's really harmful also from an investment standpoint, because you're then looking at, okay, but the number of organic farms is like 1% or something like that of all farms. The number of regenerative organic is even tinier. But then if you say, okay, well, the number of regenerative is growing, it's still a very small percentage of farms. And I would argue that every farmer, regardless of what they call themselves, wants to produce healthy, tasty food. They would love to produce something that their kids are excited to eat, you know, and I think kids are one of the best litmus tests for if you don't have a fancy lab for quality of, do the kids want to eat this without adding all kinds of sugar or condiments or flavorings to it.
Do they want to eat more of it? I think it was one of the goals of Jeroen.
Yes.
A potato that people order more, that his children would say, I want another one.
Yeah.
And of course, many farmers, unfortunately, don't grow food for their kids because they grow feed and ingredients for ethanol and other weird ingredients. Not because of
that's
their fault,
true.
Again, not shaming. But I think the inherent reason you're in that space is to grow food for people, your children, and your community. And
But at the same time, we need... You make me remember, we need to recognize that these are businesses for these farmers, and they need to be able to put food on the table for their families. And the profit margins are so slim, and they're getting so much pressure to protect the environment and change their practices, and not enough support financially to make those changes. because we're not seeing increases in premium pricing for those products, we're seeing companies that want to claim net zero and claim their carbon sequestration, but not really translating that into dollar signs for the farmer. So farmer, at the end of the day, does need yield, you know, in order to make his quotas, in order to make sure that he's hitting that profit. So I'd say this is also an exciting area for the biology in the soil, because I have seen stories and farms where, again, they are increasing their yields beyond what they thought was possible with a chemical approach. I think for investors, to get to some of your questions from earlier, how I would look at this is, what is a solution that doesn't just scale for regenerative, but redefines how we look at farming and makes it accessible for all farmers, including conventional farmers, to adopt and to improve their profit margins. And I don't think that that's a pie in the sky dream. I think that that is very much the promise of biology, soil biology, and within reach. I would say in the next 5 to 7 years, we're going to be seeing just huge changes in how we approach farming in general. But I don't have a crystal ball, but that's where my sense.
Coming back to those potential premiums, or how to get more money to the farm. Of course, one of those is to make sure less money goes off, which are inputs, which are costs, etc. But another one is potential premiums. I'm not saying they are there. Do you feel, coming back to the nutrient quality or the quality discussion in general, are you excited, pessimistic about the opportunity there to bring more cash to the land?
Mm-hmm. I'm hesitant to get excited on that. I have more faith in natural systems and biology than I do in people, and people wanting, and in particular, the greed of people. And I think that that's what our sort of capitalist system is set up as at the moment of, in order to give farmers those premiums or potentially more, let's say, trickle down of what that final dollar amount is selling a more nutritious product to the consumer. That means that the value chain that's in between there, someone else has got to hand it down. And I don't have as much faith in the companies that are in place right now. I think we're seeing a good move in companies wanting to have, be a B Corp or have a triple bottom line, people, planet, and profits. But putting that into practice and actually handing some of those funds back down to the farmer isn't as easy. And I think that's why we're seeing all of these farmer riots all across Europe and the UK. And yeah, so I'm not so optimistic for the returns that we're going to be getting, I think, in terms of maybe better quality, getting a better price at the supermarket right away. I think that it should absolutely be translated into better profits for the farmers. But still, I think, I'm not as optimistic about our capitalist system and how it's structured. So I really believe that we need to see government regulation come in and that's when we'll start to see more fair prices going to farmers.
And so you see a bigger opportunity now to drastically reduce costs very mm-hmm. soon to get bourbonine and thus kickstarting biology and having other opportunities because it fits into the current system. And the only people that get hurt are the input companies and not necessarily anybody else. Or precisely. It doesn't require a huge shift. It requires a huge shift, but not a massive shift, let's say, in spending patterns and consciousness and, let's say, shifting priorities for people in the supermarket.
Yeah. I would say you probably have already mentioned this, but the Nutrient Density Alliance just put out the first white paper on nutrient density. We haven't discussed that yet. I think that is an incredible resource to show how companies are shifting not just how they look at nutrition, but also how they market for it, what their messaging is to consumers, how that's changing, how awareness is changing amongst consumers. But as you mentioned, I think that fits in more with the current paradigm or the current system, let's say, of I do think that those food companies will be the ones that will keep most of those profits. Although you're seeing more and more messaging from, I mean, even my sister was saying that she gets her milk in the States now and it says that it comes from a family farm. She was like, I don't know how it could, there are that many family farms still in the US that much, because she was saying it's not the greatest brand. But if that's the messaging that's going out there, and that's what's selling, that means that's what's mm-hmm. important to consumers. So again, I think we need regulation to ensure that this isn't greenwashing, that we don't have a company that is saying, oh, this is coming from a family farm, when it's, in fact, mass dairy production precisely. But yeah, I think the work that that went into that white paper.
Yeah, but it reminds me of a conversation. No, sorry, go ahead. I'll put it below, of course, the white paper and shout out to Tina.
And Tina Owens, yes, absolutely.
A while back. But sorry, you were saying?
No, I think that white paper is pivotal in terms of better understanding the shift that's happening. But my concern is that the shift is going to be not something that's felt at the farm level. And that's where I think that in order to have things at the farm gate for farmers to change their potential for profit, we would need to see a bigger system change throughout the value chain. And that is more difficult, I think.
Yeah, no, what it reminded me of is a conversation we had with Heather Berry of Good Sam and their packaging and which really focuses on the farmers. So not necessarily, oh, this is good for soil, this is good for, et cetera. But what they discovered is that just like your sister mentioned, actually sells. And of course, you have to back it up with real farmers. Otherwise, what are we doing? But it is something that inherently we're like, okay, this comes from small farmers or small farms. So we feel better about it. Or there's something in our psyche that triggers that. And now it's our job to use that in a sense and make sure it's backed up by real farmers and real money flows to the farmers. But I really get your central point of let's reduce massive costs on massive farms as soon as possible, because it's just wasted money. And it can be done relatively quickly compared to changing the minds of hundreds of thousands of consumers and millions of consumers in a supermarket. That's a tricky, that's other work to be done there. Anything else, random trivia that you want to share before we wrap up?
That's a good one. Let's see. I think the other thing that maybe was unsaid with this, it's understood by me, but maybe just to make sure that it's explicit, is by trusting in the biology in the soil and sort of this potential, the impact from an ecosystem standpoint and all of the other life that's involved would also be healthier. Our water systems would be cleaner. And I think that the overall impact and the spread of that impact from switching from a chemical-based concept of farming to a biology-based concept of farming doesn't just make for more nutritious and healthy food for us and bodies, for those of us consuming it, but really influences the health of our environments. And I think that we are much more connected health-wise to the health of our environments. I mean, you talk to someone, there's studies also, of course, but if someone's very stressed and they've been in the office all day, like if they have the ability to go walk through a forest and hear the sounds of the birds and the trees, there's a calming effect. And we're just beginning to also unlock that connection and how interconnected we are with our natural environment. And so I think from a human health and well-being perspective, it's not just the nutritious quantities of what's measurable in the food that we're eating, but also our entire ecosystem and how we're a part of that ecosystem, and it's intrinsically linked.
And do you see studies coming out there, like I'm thinking of the forest bathing prescriptions in Japan, but just our natural environment, which most of us, unfortunately, are living in cities, a comfortable life to a certain extent, but definitely lacking nature, like a nature deficit.
Yeah.
Do you see exciting things coming out there as well to like greener cities? I don't know. They've got to quantify that more. And of course, then you lose some of the complexity, but still.
Yeah, there are. So I, for the soil sommelier side, just put together a project where we were looking at this as well to see what studies are out there connecting human well-being to the environment and to soil. And so I go from the smell perspective. So there's, I don't know if, did we talk about this?
Explain petrichor? What is a soil sommelier. I had it here in my notes to ask you if we discuss it yet, but now you mentioned it, so now we have to go there. What is the soil sommelier?
So a soil sommelier is someone who uses their connection to, or their sense of smell and observation to determine the quality of a soil. But also the concept intrinsically links our connection to soil and soil life, and how we've co-evolved together. It's a little tongue-in-cheek in that I think the real soil sommeliers are the farmers, however they want to define themselves, regenerative, organic, but who are very much connected with their natural habitat that is on their farm. This concept also started from understanding how connected we are as humans and our sense of smell and how it's co-evolved with the soil. So I don't know if you're familiar with the smell after it rains. It's like a fresh, earthy smell.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's called petrichor. And petrichor is made of ozone and geosmin. And geosmin is a chemical that's released by a soil microbe in actinomycete in the streptonomycete family. And the streptonomycete family of soil microbes, just some other connections, is also connected to some of our very important antibiotics in the medicine world. But a human's ability to smell this bacteria, a chemical that's released when this bacteria dies after it rains, is somewhere between 1 to 100 parts per trillion. And to give a frame of reference, a shark can smell blood in the water at, it's like 1 to 2 parts per billion. So a human nose is better able, the untrained human nose is better able to sense what a healthy soil is or healthy soil life than a shark is able to sense blood in the water. And I like to use that to just reinforce that every single one of us has, we're the result of millennia of coevolution with the plants and ultimately soil bacteria around us. And we have this ability. So I'll do like soil tastings where this is something that evolved from having people smell in a teaspoon to then I found that if you put soil into wine glasses, people get really excited and it doesn't matter what anyone's background is. They will happily go and smell that wine glass of soil. And I'll have 5 different kinds of soil and I'll ask people to rate which they think is from the regenerative farm, which is from the conventional farm, which is a degraded one. And yeah, it varies depending on the group and depending on where I am, because I don't bring soil with me. I'll go out and sort of hunt it from the environment near wherever the conference is or whatnot. But yeah, that's sort of the background of what a soil sommelier is. And yeah, it's really encouraging people to recognize how connected we are to nature.
And how our untrained people are able to are able to do it. Like untrained people are.
The untrained nose.
You said tasting, so, you mean smelling. I think you're not eating
the soil. Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, no one's eating the soil. it's smelling. And yeah, so it varies. Because sometimes I'll only have one healthy one and one unhealthy one and ask them to tell which is which. So, of course, it's a 50-50. But I had one where I had the 5 glasses and we had a contest. So we asked people to there was a number next to each one. And we asked them out of the 5 to guess which they thought was the regenerative one. And the winners all got some Yara salsa from Andres from Staatsgrünte Boer, a farmer here in Amsterdam. And we were shocked because I think it was about 40 people.
On the list to be interviewed soon.
Yes,
shout out
good.
To Andres.
Yeah. Nice. But we were shocked because out of maybe 40 people that participated, it was like 17 that got it right. And there was like, there was one that was very good soil, but it wasn't the regenerative one. So it wasn't that easy. So taking that a step further, we just put together we just applied for a grant to do a study with a neuroscientist, in Italy. The company is Strobilo, and what they do is they measure, sort of brain wave activity to environmental stimuli, specifically what we were talking about in terms of, you know, are there studies or are there people out there doing this? And I got introduced to Andrea Baricelli, the founder at Future Food Institute, for a Climate Shapers boot camp. And he was giving a talk on how some of the tests that he had done was on honey and flavor and on olive oil. And so people were given a blind taste test and they were asked which one was the healthiest and which one sort of tasted the best. And people were choosing ones that had maybe more sugar or more sweets or palatable. But every time their brain, the unconscious part of their brain, would spike on the one that had the most polyphenols, the most terpenes, the most bioactives, and was the healthiest for their body. So we've kind of forgotten this ability, but our brain hasn't. And that's because if you look at thousands and thousands and maybe millions of years of evolution, that doesn't just disappear with 3 or 4 generations of fast food. food and industrialization. So we still have this ability to connect with nature, to understand what is healthy. And so we put a proposal together to use the same brain scan EEG concept, but for soil, and to really try and see if we can visualize or get information back that validates this notion that anyone is able to smell what a healthier soil is, and if there is in fact brain activity that helps us to identify what is the healthy one versus the not healthy one. So we'll have 5 soil samples in that study if we get the funding. But yeah, so I'm excited about that too.
Wow, and I think that's a perfect end to, I think we opened Pandora box of the amount of random but super interesting and relevant region trivia. I feel a follow-up interview, a conversation happening at some point. I want to thank you so much for coming on here again, for sharing
so
what excites you, interests you, surprises you, and what keeps you going. So thank you so much for coming on here and sharing whatever
Absolutely.
You found fascinating in the last year and beyond.
Thank you. It's an absolute honor to be on here. As always, I enjoy the conversation. Thank you for taking the time and for your really good and thoughtful questions. I think really also we all need to be thinking about some of these things and how they relate also to the bigger picture and to finance and how do we create solutions here. So it's a lot of different areas, but again, thank you and Antonella for all of the work that you're doing, especially in educating all of us and sort of helping to share this knowledge that's out there. I know I always enjoy the different people that you bring on. So again, I'm honored to be one of them and always happy to come back. Thank you.
That will definitely happen. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.